Chapter 16. ST. Woodland Park Zoo, Seattle, Washington, USA. We were losing light and I didn't like it. I instructed Dennis to wait by the turnstile gate. It was safer for me to be airborne, and my heebie-jeebies were telling me to do recon of the zoo solo. Besides, Big Jim never brought Dennis to the zoo, even though he snuck me in once. My suspicion is that Big Jim had been shielding him from an alpaca exhibit. Inexplicably, Dennis is deathly afraid of alpacas. But leaving him on the ground at the mouth of the Woodland Park Zoo, vulnerable, a survival greenhorn, felt like nothing I'd ever experienced. Caches, especially ones I'd stuffed with special sought-after treasures like golf balls, antique mofo collectibles, Rolls-Royce hood ornaments, or Tinder Tiffany's diaphragm, were always very hard to leave. After the electric thrill of meticulously concealing my treasure, I'd always embark on the Oscar-worthy theatrical production of Nonchalance, pretending the new cache didn't exist and that I wasn't thinking about it 24/7. This was so much worse. Leaving Dennis was to feel a chronic, hollow ache, untreatable until I saw his ridiculously saggy skin again. I fluffed myself up and fluttered over the gate, finding stacks of rock formations. In full investigation mode, I lowered to perch atop one of the large beige rocks. Speckling of the very worst kind of white shit told me what I needed to know. This was where the penguins lived. I gagged, barely holding in partially digested garbanzo flour chocolate chip cookie. The thought of those bollock Jedis living here, shitting their lives away on mofo property, was difficult. And now, where were they? The glass that looked to have held a large pool of water for the Wang Bangs to swim in was now in shining shards. A world where penguins roamed free. God help us all. I thought about how Big Jim hated penguins and how he had laughed at them the time he took me to the zoo. They were weird, fake-ass birds that couldn't fly, strange and useless. "What in the hell is the point of a bird that can't fly?" he had said in between bites of a chili dog. He said they were a waste of space, much like people who believe in ludicrous things like environmental protection and tofu. A comet shot across the sky. Then I saw something else. Streak, jet black, careen above the tree line. Two crows were performing aerial gymnastics, soaring high above, only to descend into a pirouette of corkscrew dives. They were fucking playing. My blood boiled. I snorted my contempt and got back to attending urgent matters and exhibiting productive behavior in a world that was falling apart. Across from the penguin enclosure was a large roof I recognized as the zoo store. Dipping down, I saw the store had been ransacked, floor-to-ceiling windows smashed, counters and tables shattered, wooden display walls crushed into fine powder. T-shirts lay mud-smeared and trampled. Something had made quick work of a snack display, then gone on to decapitate and de-stuff a mound of plush animals. Hats, bags, coffee canteens, and African drums lay abandoned and wrecked. In an unambiguous statement, a mountainous pastiche of dung sat under a busted doorframe. The disrespect for mofo property and the eerie silence bothered me, but the image of a tiny, dejected Pomeranian, all alone with her ginger head in her paws as the black tide came in to swallow her, tugged at my heart and kept me focused. I lifted, more determined than ever to find the one who opens doors, a mofo, blood pumping through his veins, his head populated with red strands and innovative thoughts. I knew he was here. Woodland Park Zoo had changed its spots. There had been monumental upheaval here. From above, I could see how the foliage had declared war, bursting forth from the soil, electric green and surging with life. Tropical vines and stranglers were performing a creeping asphyxiation of the zoo. They were forming their own vertical superhighways as weeping willows surveyed them from above. Carnivorous pitcher plants with their baited jugs of acid had spread, readying for carnage. Bromeliads and Japanese quince and Tartarian honeysuckle, magnolias, red elderberry, English laurel, and bishop's hat were active commanders in this battle, all wild and hungry and glossy green. I thought it a diverse and unnatural tussle. In some areas of the zoo, walkways were smothered in plant life, the sides of buildings held hostage by a weedy ambush. What I saw was silent war. This was a hostile takeover, the foliage committing mass destruction, swallowing up concrete 1 millimeter at a time. The mofo who'd been freeing the animals hadn't been maintaining the flora. I could see how it would just be too big a job, how garden greens can fight back and swallow a city whole. And I imagined he'd been busy doing what he'd been doing, surviving. A flash of movement caught my eye, so I gingerly perched halfway up a towering Sitka spruce and traced the motion. Ambling below was a hulking mass of muscle with the prickly skin of a durian. It took its time, veined and prehistoric, dragging its legs and shadowed claws along a walkway of weeds. Locked in terrifying jaws that leaked frothy strings of spittle was the limp body of a meerkat. The Komodo stopped, lifting his blocky head to register me. Our eyes met and my knees buckled. The dragon let the meerkat's lifeless form drop like a winter stole. A dagger-like tongue in salmon pink stabbed the air, tasting me, licking information about the one who keeps. I felt my throat close, an anger I could barely contain surging through me. This creature was godlike, mesmerizing me with his armored form, genes that stretched back millions of years through time. I would never be a match for him. We both knew this. And here he moved with the slow sovereignty of the vines and the ivy. He was silent and insidious in his takeover, assuming dominance over his new domain, with no respect for the lives that we were losing, no understanding that this wasn't his world to conquer. "This is the world of the mofos!" I yelled at the dragon. They had sculpted and designed and trimmed and cut down and bettered everything. And here was Komodo, cool and commanding, an indomitable takeover. Like nature, the predator that shows no mercy. He was lumbering, puissant proof that mofos were losing a battle against the earth. "You disgust me, you scaly fuckbucket!" I screamed at him. Then I took flight before I did something utterly stupid. My eyes darted, wings cutting through the air with frantic flaps that sounded like the flicking of cotton sheets. I scoured for movement, for red hair, for the soldier who'd helped me win this war. I lowered into an area called Banyan Wilds, a recreation of tropical Asia, rife with thick vines and bamboo. I hovered over an enclosure that said it contained sloth bears, but found its star occupants missing, the glass wall along the front of the enclosure in shards. Perching on a large rock, I studied the terrain, searching for signs of life. A burning sensation in the back of my head told me I was being watched. I hopped and spun to find three sets of shining eyes watching me with heads cocked. I felt the feathers on the back of my neck hike up. Crows. They sat on a thick log that balanced on the sloth bear's sunbathing rock and conferred with one another in a series of clicks and rattles. I blocked them out. I flapped to a neighboring enclosure, finding it to be the densely jungled home of the Malayan tigers. Again, the enclosure was empty, glass front gone. My heart started to race. To avoid the nuclear meltdown that was building steadily inside me, I lifted again, looking for my mofo, flying above an enclosure that had a covered viewing area which had information and signs about its inhabitants. The safety glass, to prevent visiting mofos from coming face-to-face with 8 350-pound western lowland gorillas, lay shattered all over the hay and concrete. Acid rose in my throat. I swallowed and hurriedly took flight. My mofo was here, and I knew it. Discovering fragmented glass at the front of the jaguar exhibit made flying difficult as a tremor took hold of my wings. "Where are you, mofo?" I beat my wings, trying to stay airborne, trying to breathe as I fluttered over a building in the rainforest loop. It had a glass roof, and when I found it to be intact, my pinions stabilized, normal flight possible again. Intact glass, a crystalline beacon of hope. I ducked into the building and was transported to the tropics by thick vines and the bulbous, gnarly rooted buttresses of exotic trees. Animal exhibits sat side by side, Goliath, pink toe tarantula, yellow anaconda, false water cobra, poison dart frog, emerald tree boa, tiger rat snake. The animals were all gone, a tiling of debris and glass glittering on the ground. I started to hyperventilate as if the anaconda had its muscly middle squeezing tightly around my throat. I shot by the enclosures, searching for life and signs of a mofo's intent, a glass-shattering axe, a life hammer, an emergency window-breaker escape tool, when I felt eyes upon me. Squatting on a log in the rainforest building, surrounded by thick foliage and signs of a mass evacuation, sat a shiny body. He stared at me with a smug expression, a pseudo-smirk. "Where are the healthy mofos?" I asked him, my breath hitched. "The ones who walk on two legs."
"Past the Moonstone River."
His skin was lime green, as polished as an airport shoe. His funny little nostrils twitched, and his face made it hard to believe he wasn't making fun of me, which was adding to my agitation. "What? That's not what I asked you. Where are the mofos?" I asked, reading the sign behind his shattered terrarium that identified him as a waxy monkey tree frog.
"Past the Moonstone River," he repeated himself,
and I shot out of there, the fury inside me billowing like hot gas. I didn't have a second longer to spend in the company of a bewildered frog and his stupid waxy rictus. It seemed beneath me to eat a tropical frog out of spite, so I bottled my rage and took off. I scoured the tropical rainforest building, huffing in tight-chested breaths, a reedy whistle emanating from deep inside me. I searched tropical bird aviaries, bananaquits, red-crested finches, blue-gray tanagers, spangled cotingas. They were all gone. An ocelot and a bushmaster, which, according to the unflattering sign by its empty enclosure, is a venomous serpent with delightful heat detector pits on both sides of its head that hides in the soil, waiting to assassinate passing mammals, were nowhere to be seen. Even the home of my acquaintances, the golden lion tamarin enclosure, lay empty. And the glass, everywhere, sprinkled like fallen icicles, every shard breaking my heart. And then I found the toucan exhibit. There was no visible toucan, no lollipop-beaked bird who lorded over your childhood cereal bowl. The exhibit was pit-like, with an open grated roof and intact wire-mesh fencing on its periphery. Stuffed like spam were all the mofos who had fallen in through the grating, filling every inch of the enclosure. The mass pulsated like a breathing tumor. The mofos were rotting and moaning, eyeballs pressed through the mesh fence, greenish skin torn and ripped. They looked and smelled like Dennis's canned dinner. Animals free, mofos caged. My heart trailing along by my feet, I searched in the mass of meat for red hair, one eye open for the ambushmaster that the one had at some point freed. It was impossible to identify every mofo in that palpitating tumor, but I felt a glimmer of hope spark. I couldn't see red hair. Feathereds, furs, mofos, the scaled. We all share the gift of a special sense. Intuition. Our otherworldly knowing. Mine told me that he wasn't in the pit, but that I would find him. Thwack! Something struck me in the back of the head. I squawked, shooting off the toucan habitat's viewing ledge. Five crows with dusty feathers and mischief alight in their eyes peered at me from branches inside the golden lion tamarin's busted enclosure. These were not college crows. These were a different murder, a spiteful, careless bunch of clowns who belonged behind the bars of an aviary. One had pelted something at me, a seed, a piece of fruit. I didn't know and didn't care what it was. I hated these inky fools, these lentil-brained ass noodles. "Get away from me!" I screeched, flapping alongside the mass of disfigured mofos. Had they no compassion? No understanding of what was happening to the wonderful world around them? The devastating mass of sick mofos caged beside them really meant nothing at all to them? One of them cackled and launched another rapid-fire round of seeds at me. I ducked. I'd fucking had it.
I charged, screaming my anguish, flapping my ferocity. I dove into the golden lion tamarin habitat, flushing out their black bodies and chasing them through the enclosed tunnel of exhibits. They squawked excitable panic and nervous laughter, gas on the flames of my fury. We burst from the tunnel, and the crows shot skyward, scattering into the evening, cackling and chattering. It was a game to them. I'd lost my whole life, everything that made sense to me, and they thought it was funny. I hated crows, hated everything about their horrible, shadowy chicanery and ignorance. They were a limited species, bird-brained and primitive. I fluttered my gueuler, hating the part of me that they recognized, desperately wanting to pluck off my wings and walk on two legs and have a limitless imagination. I was sick of being a patchwork of puzzle pieces, parts of this and bits of that. I was one color but not one thing. I wanted to be perceived, to look and sound and act like I felt inside, like a mofo. In a state, I puffed and huffed as I flew southward over the zoo, ravaged by adrenaline and fear and the pain of hope. Hair-raising omens popped up in the forms of a limp raccoon that hung over a branch like a Christmas ornament, and dazzling white bones that littered the family farm petting zoo, informing my decision to steer clear of the nearby temperate forest area. The African savanna seemed a wiser choice, so I settled onto a black locust tree, squawked as I impaled a foot on one of its hideous thorns, and quickly abandoned ship for a Russian olive instead. I worked on trying to calm my nerves, using Lamaze techniques I'd learned from MTV. The pressure was strangling me. Pressure of time, of leaving Dennis, of losing light, of finding the one who opens doors, of rescuing a desperate little Pomeranian, of hating what I was born as, of wanting change in every single iota of my life. I Lamazed methodically, listening for guidance from inside, from trees, from anywhere. Nothing came. My pulse started to stabilize. From my high branch, I had an unobstructed vantage point of a series of Kikuyu huts, a quaint rendering of an East African village. I wondered whether the real East African mofos still had their thatched homes, painting their faces in bold white and red pastes, fashioning their jewelry from bead and cowrie shell, whether lions were still a threat to them. My bones were tired from my panicked tour of the world through a zoo. I realized I wasn't alone. A grating honking trumpeted into the air. The horrible sound tightened into staccato shrieks, immediately recognizable as a call of distress. In the middle of the African village, a flamingo dragged itself along the ground, singing its anguish in sharp and flat notes. Her sugar-pink wing hung at an odd angle, dangling near fuchsia chopstick legs that thrashed, kicking up sand. I had a bad feeling about this, thinking of the brawny king of reptiles and his casually chilling swagger. And the bushmaster, the largest of all pit vipers, lurking somewhere in the burgeoning shadows. The flamingo's cries echoed among the Kikuyu huts, the smell of fear tight and sharp in the darkening air. I grappled with whether to drop down to help the flamingo. If she wasn't a domestic but was still cared for by mofos, did I get involved? A silvery shadow encroached, making the decision for me. The leopard was the color of a winter sky, sprinkled with a snowing of perfect black circles. She was at once soft and formidable, rounded with gentle curves and pillowy paws, sheaths for her retractable weapons. A study in contrasts, a voluptuous tail trailed behind her. Her movements were methodical, each paw placement deliberate. The pellucid green eyes that lit her round face trained on the injured pink bird. "Run!" I screeched at the flamingo. "Get out of there!" I didn't want to watch, but I couldn't help myself. 10 paw prints in the sand were all the flamingo had left, and then its neck was in the jaws of the snow leopard. A sharp shake. A snap. She fell silent. The leopard suddenly dropped the flamingo's limp salmon neck, her rapt attention on one of the Kikuyu huts. Her body changed. The ripple that shuddered under that plush winter coat was almost invisible. She had known he was coming before she saw him, before either of us saw the brooding body that strode from the hut. We hadn't seen him waiting, watching, his camouflage blending into shadows. He is seen only when he wants to be. Now the flamingo had been dispatched, and he was here to claim it. A guttural growl rumbled the roots of the Russian olive tree. From ground and branch, the snow leopard and I shared terror of brilliant orange and black stripes that stood in the center of the African village. The tiger let the growl rev and crescendo into a roar, exposing long yellowed fangs, eyes and nose wrinkling. The snow leopard tensed, placed two plush paws in front of her pink prize. Here was another war. The tiger rushed her, stopping short of her face, thrashing enormous claws. Snow leopard swiped back, her silvery paw colliding with the side of his head. Roars erupted from the throat of the tiger. The cats, one of jungle, one of snow, lifted onto their hind legs in a horrific embrace, clawing and thrashing for dominance. A lightning round of powerful, reflexive attacks. Jab, claw, swipe, lunge, charge. Agile jerks and pivots. Fur was airborne, so fast, fast as flames. The leopard let four paws hit the sand first. The tiger paced, huffed. He inched forward, met by a flurry of swipes and strained, high-pitched yowls from the leopard. Teeth and claw and fury flew. My feet strangled the branch. Tiger's face twisted with a snarl. He bit at her head with 3-inch scythes. Leopard snatched the scruff of Tiger's throat. She slammed him onto his side. And then it stopped. The leopard shot back, eyes on the tiger as she retreated, exposing the flamingo. The tiger shook his massive head and postured over the bird that lay like a broken lawn ornament. Snow Leopard backed up slowly, farther, relinquishing her coveted kill. I didn't understand. Hadn't she been winning? And then her reason became clear. A sinister veil of orange and black skulked from the huts. The stripes of two more tigers, shoulder blades undulating in a liquid rise and fall, entered the African village. There were three brothers who met one another. Two tigers sniffed the victor, and with a minor squabble over the blushing bird, they tore apart her corpse. I was losing my mind. This is what Seattle had become? A battleground? A gladiator's pit of savages? And then a delicious acorn of a thought dropped. If I was a lone, healthy, red-headed mofo, surrounded by a brotherhood of tigers and a bushmaster and a snow leopard and an acid-mouthed Komodo dragon, I wouldn't make myself easy to find either. I'd be hiding somewhere sneaky and difficult to locate. Just like how after the big thing went down with Tiffany S., Big Jim battened down the hatches, taking up residency in the basement with World of Warcraft, Jägermeister, and Papa John's on speed dial. He'd gone to ground. I'd been searching out in the open, but that's not where a mofo in his predicament would be. Alone, he would find himself prey in these surroundings. Suddenly, I was deafened by a hideous chorus of raucous screeching. It was that murder again. The trees around me were alive with their opened beaks, their insistent screams. They were taunting me. "Get away! Get away!" they squawked, and I hated them so very, very much, even more than the smell of Abercrombie and Fitch, those crumble cheese turd burgers. Crows shot out of the trees. A storm of them charged forth, beaks careening toward me. "Hey!" I squawked, as one of the crows body-checked me square in the chest. Instantly winded, I tumbled from the tree. Plummeting toward the earth, I quickly righted myself at the last inch, turning just in time to see an orange paw swiping down at me. I shot sideways, evading the tiger's hair-trigger killer instinct, escaping into the air. The brother jumped, hurling his striped bulk at me from below, excited by the thrill of a chase. I flapped hard, consumed by hatred for the pistachio-brained birds who'd almost gotten me killed. "What's the matter with you assholes?" I squawked rhetorically. But none of them were looking at me. They continued to scream, "Get away! Get away!" But I realized it was directed at a monster who was inching its way along the Russian olive, its trowel head tasting me where I had sat seconds before. The crows had pushed me away from the strike of a 20-foot snake whose glossy body shone with the diamond pattern of a Persian carpet, even in the growing darkness. I was stunned. In shock from the savagery and the unexpected source of help, I bolted. I had to get away from the craziness. I couldn't process anything that was happening, and I couldn't leave Dennis a second longer. If I stayed here, it was only a matter of time before I became as delusional as that waxy monkey tree frog. I was having a lot of trouble with my breathing, which I chalked up to nearly getting quesadilla'd between tiger paws and becoming a hot pocket for a snake the size of a sewer pipe. But I didn't have time to rest. My search from the sky continued as I passed over the rest of the zoo's African savanna. Once crisp and dry, now gaining green and looking like it had been ravaged by a storm. I flew north to an area thick with firs, cedars, hemlocks, and plants native to my Washington home. None of this helped diminish the sharp pain in my chest, which ceased only when I spotted a cluster of moving bodies below. I made out the top of a ball cap, dark hair, a bald spot, long brown hair, and in the middle of this group of mofos, a redhead. I crowed my triumph to the clouds. "He's here! He's here!" I dipped down, carefully checking the branches of a black spruce before perching. The bird's eye view and lack of light wouldn't let me see the mofo's face, just his bright ginger hair as he and the small group of straight-backed mofos he was with made their way along a path on the northern trail toward a cave. They were seeking shelter. I shook my head, incredulous. There was hope. There was life. A living mofo. A chance at saving the world. I ducked down to follow them into the cave. It turned out to be a ground-level viewing station for zoo visitors to watch the brown bears and the otters. Unbelievably, the glass to both enclosures was still intact. They'd come here to seek refuge, to use their heads. They were here to devise a plan for survival and to contain the escaped animals. The mofos gathered together in front of the glass of the brown bear exhibit, ripples from the wading water catching the last traces of light and making them dance around the cave. From the ground, I watched my red-headed mofo as he approached the glass, pressing an intact hand against its surface. He drew his head backward as if in mesmeric reverence, expressing gratitude to a power high above. There was a moment of silence. Then he bashed his head against the glass with a hollow crack. "No." He shot his head back and launched it at the glass again with a thwack. "No." The romp of otters in the neighboring enclosure swarmed in a cloud of panic. The mofos around the redhead joined him in bashing their skulls with superlative power. "No." In front of them, separated by a small wading pool and some glass, two famished brown bears paced on the water's edge. "No." The smacking became more frantic. Clack, clack, clack. "No." The first crack in the glass was born, shooting like a tiny lightning streak and allowing for the breath of chaos. Clack, clack, clack. The mofos kept using their heads. "No." The crack grew branches, which ripped through the glass. "No." The bear's impatient dance intensified, one of them excitedly lifting on his hind legs. He was standing, a mirror of the mofos. They waited, stomachs and throats releasing low growls of anticipation for what was coming to them. From the air, I heard the horrific sounds of gushing water and a bear breaking fast, a sound I will forever hear on clammy nights when sleep is elusive. I'd been given false information. A scheme. I had blindly trusted the information from Aura, and it had been wrong. A lie. No better than an email scam. It was exactly like the real internet, filled with festering weirdos and keyboard clowns. I should have known. Should have remembered how Big Jim felt when he'd fallen hard for Oksana, a duck-billed Russian beauty with whom he'd been messaging for months. After swapping intimate details, addresses, deep secrets, and a series of Anthony Weiner-inspired photos, Big Jim sent Oksana $4,000 to cover her airline ticket to Seattle, her rent, and liquid courage in a bottle of Stolichnaya Elite so she could leave her abusive husband. Oksana turned out to be a cyber fabrication. Big Jim had been spilling the contents of his heart and scrotum to an online troll. Now, I'd fallen for it, too. Fallen for the lies of three asshats who'd concocted a story about a redhead. They had sold me the same thing that Oksana had sold to Big Jim. False hope. Because what I realized, watching the redheaded mofo in the Bear and Otter viewing area, was that all of the glass in the city had been smashed by the sick mofos. I remembered the cell phone bait dangling from the lamppost, where mofos teemed below, hurling themselves to reach it. I thought about the message at the Oyster House. Tell Peter John Stein I love him. Tell him, but do not use your phone. And I thought about Big Jim when I pulled out his cell phone, how he'd gone from swiping the basement walls mindlessly with his finger to being a savage hunter, a desperate monster. There had been no vigilante redhead setting the zoo animals free out of the goodness of his heart. The sick mofos no longer had hearts. I'd known they were looking for phones, but I hadn't put it all together in my blindness. They were attracted to all the glass because they'd mistaken it for what they were really looking for. Screens. I flew above the zoo's twisted green mass, the stabbing pain in my chest back again. It was hard to stay airborne. Maybe because of the weight in my heart, because you can't fly when it's heavy. The adage is so true. Maybe, I thought, something is deeply wrong. And suddenly I found I could no longer flap my wings, and I plummeted, crashing into rolling tumbles. Head, wing, side, foot, repeat, hitting the ground. I came to a stop, wings akimbo. The landing of a challenged fledgling. I righted myself, shaking off the dirt and staring at the sign in front of me. It depicted a scene. In its center was a picture of a green stroller. Next to the stroller was a picture of a sandwich bag full of goldfish crackers. A sinister silhouette had taken the sandwich bag hostage, holding it above the stroller, taunting, malicious. "Stow your snacks," said the sign. The silhouette was a crow. I couldn't take it anymore. I launched into the air, using every ounce of what I had left, heart on fire, and flapped as fast as I could, away from the crows and the savagery and the lies, streaming above a world that had too many thorns for me. I had to get back to Dennis, to the last remnant of sanity I had. Darkness had spread its onyx blanket, and that might have been why I committed the most classic and fatal of avian bloopers. Particularly ironic, given the lack of intact glass to be found. I smashed full speed into a glass window. Stunned on impact, my legs stiffened as I plunged to earth, vision turning to black. Chapter 17. Atlanta, Georgia, USA. As told by an armadillo whose name roughly translates as Elwood. Air is hot. Full of things to come. Have to get home. Scurry there. Be safe again. Air is getting dark and angry. I hurry my way through the jungle that has grown. Green vines cover everywhere I go now. Bush and flower and shrub. Fields that were once of grass and the bones of cow and sheep now belong to the vines. Kudzu vines are from another place far away, but now they have made my home theirs. They are hungry to cover and smother everything they can, and now we live in green. Crack! The air is angry. It roars and gathers its black clouds for a reckoning. Hurry home, Elwood. Hurry to the home. Scurry over flat kudzu leaves. Look up and see them crawling all over buckeye, pawpaw, devil's walking stick, hornbeam, holly, and hickory. A great green battle. When the kudzu came to our home, it brought its bugs, little creatures with red eyes and mean spirits. They eat other greens, and the kudzu grows and grows here, king of the south. They bring secrets from a faraway place, stories of molting cherry trees and snow monkeys that bathe in hot spring water. We cannot tell if they are truthful. They don't share everything they know, and we don't welcome them because they are not like us. Crack! Hurry home, Elwood. The sky flashes hot white. I am almost there, almost home. Groundhogs and skunks are heading to their dens to hide from the hot, angry air. I am home. I get ready to dip down into my tunnels, but another great white flash splits the air. The white streak strikes Cobra quick. It has declared war on the kudzu. The kudzu is now hot, bright orange, and burning. Smoke rises, mean gray curls. I'm here, says the smoke. The sky is mine. The burning spreads, killing up the kudzu. I smell its smoky green death. Hurry home, Elwood. I dip into my tunnels and wait. This is my home. I'll just wait here to see who wins. Chapter 18. ST, unconscious. Whereabouts unknown. My nictitating membranes slid open like rain-slick patio doors. A nose the size of Saturn took up my entire field of vision. As it gave a weather vane spinning sniff, its gravitational pull sucked up my feathers. The nose then retreated, allowing me to take in more of its owner's face. Flapping fawn folds of skin, drooping, near-melted eyes that gave an air of constant hopelessness. Dangling dangerously close to my eye was a bizarre turkey waddle reminiscent of an elephant's testicles. Never in my wildest night terrors did I think I'd be so happy to see Dennis's slimy jowls, the bubbles of saliva poised to spill over their sides. Dennis snorted his happiness at my consciousness, excitedly sniffing me from tail to beak, licking my feathers, and nudging me with that spongy, omniscient schnoz. I righted myself and shook, freeing a shower of sticky droplets from my feathers. The scorching stabs in my chest had gone, and then I remembered my collision and lowered my head in embarrassment. I couldn't believe that I'd beak planted in a mostly glassless, Windex-free world. As I lifted my wings, a tightness and vague numb sensation constricted my movement, but I was lucky. I'd gotten away mostly unscathed. Dennis must have found me in a crumpled heap at the zoo, and then he must have carried me, held my limp body in his soft mouth, and waited with me here, hoping I would get up again. This may be a projection, but I'd like to think he felt lost without me. Where did you bring us, Dennis? A glance upward revealed a towering pyramid of needled branches. The Douglas fir. We were sitting on the stone steps of the teal and white house. The air was the blistering cold of freezer-burnt venison. Above, peeking between spiny fir limbs, blanketing blue, laced with orange and raspberry sherbet, told me it was very early in the morning. Not really a time either of us were yet accustomed to. I could tell Dennis hadn't slept by the wiry energy coming off him, like he'd been plugged in and blown a fuse. Dennis plodded to the front door and whined. He looked back at me with a face that could sink 1,000 ships, then dragged his catcher mitt paws down the length of the door. I hopped to where the window was and lifted to get a look inside. I launched my body into the air, but it immediately pitched to the side. I flapped harder, a frantic rooster's flight, and clawed onto the window ledge to peer in. Cinnamon was by the front door that separated her and Dennis, looking like a flattened hand muff. One thing was clear. The black tide had come in, its dark spume lapping at her little ginger body. She was giving up. I launched from the steps, flapping with all my might. One of my wings felt tethered as I descended to the ground in a hideous corkscrew shape like a duck penis. The other thing that was now clear was that I couldn't fly. Something had happened to my wing where the numbness lingered like a winter chill. Dennis was watching me with amber eyes. I didn't want to alarm him. We certainly couldn't have two dogs in the throes of depression. These were Cymbalta-less times, for shit's sakes. But the implications of being a near flightless bird in this brutal world were horrifying. I felt the weight of doom, as if I should be preparing my will, perhaps penning some pithy quips for my own eulogy. My defense had always been to take to the air. Now what would I do? I was a sitting duck. Perhaps a penguin, who already can't fly because they were born utterly useless, would give up in the face of a setback like this. But this wasn't an option for me. I'd been raised as a mofo, and I knew that of all the things mofos are, they are not quitters. Mofos never gave up on the belief that they could land on the moon, and by thunder, they did it! After sensibly sending up a few test subjects, including cats, tortoises, mice, mealworms, a rabbit, chimpanzees, rhesus macaques, squirrel monkeys, cynomolguses, and pigtailed monkeys, a boatload of dogs, and some fruit flies. Winston Churchill, an English mofo who liked cigars and his curtains to be made from iron, famously said, "Never, never, never give up." Steve Jobs, the mofo who invented the iPod and the black turtleneck, said, "Be punctual, never give up, achieve your goals, even when everything goes bad." He was pretty amazing. He may have been a wizard. And when Jackie Chan or Chuck Norris was surrounded by hordes of inexplicably sweaty bad guys, did they give up? Never. They fought back, avoiding a hailstorm of bullets with their mid-air body torpedo spins, who-farted expressions, and long, feathery mullets. How's that for optimism and an indelible spirit? Mofos didn't need wings to soar. Maybe being grounded would make me more mofo than ever. So I got to doing what mofos do best. I got to thinking. I thought about not having hands or working wings, and then I decided, much like a penguin tuning out the massive amount of danger it constantly faces, not to focus on what I couldn't do, but rather on what I could do. And when I thought of the things I was capable of, well, then, and only then, did a plan start to form. It was risky, wild, and far-fetched, but it was all my own. And it started with a treasure hunt. I fluttered haphazardly onto Dennis's back and gave a sharp whistle. It had become clear on this second attempt at going airborne that I now had the aviation skills of an obese chicken. Again, I tried to focus on the positive and not the comparison to a bird who likes to sing while ovulating and has the worst retirement plan of all time. Pot pie. Dennis understood that I had a plan, and both of us could feel electricity in the morning air. After Dennis urinated on the Douglas fir and I bobbed up and down, bowing out my apologies like the arm of a Maneki Neko cat, we set off along Finney Avenue. Maneuvering Dennis wasn't as straightforward as one might hope. I could have really used some reins, but we didn't have time for these sorts of luxuries. Instead, I relied upon the training I'd done with him, ordering him to stay. Or, let's go. The trickiest part was not having a system for telling him to go left or right, but I eventually found that he got the gist if I leaned in the desired direction from my perch on his thick back. Unless he smelled something that piqued his interest. Then we were screwed, and I resigned myself to fulfilling his quest to water a fire hydrant or investigate a pile of rotting trash. As usual, we were at the mercy of his honker. But for the most part, our mission was full steam ahead. Aura's stupid song had started up, but I blocked it out by humming tunes I'd once heard on the radio, including one about memories by a songbird of a mofo named Barbara Drysand. The sun was drizzling the rows of buildings on Finney Avenue with the liquid gold of a pale ale. The first area we investigated was an apartment building. The windows were all smashed, which allowed us to hop over the base of the white doorframe and into its ransacked lobby. A fake cantia palm lay on its side, terracotta pots smashed, soil spilled on the lobby tiles like leaking blood. A wall of metal mailboxes were dented and warped. A broken door beckoned. "Hello?" I said, hoping to flush out any sick mofos or anything else hiding near the lobby. Dennis and I waited. Silence. You could have heard a dust mite queef in there. Satisfied that we were alone for now, I hopped off Dennis and began searching. I had explained to him what we were looking for, but didn't feel he'd fully grasped the concept. A door was hanging by one hinge, half blocking a room that called itself the rental office. Something quite gruesome had gone down in the rental office, as evidenced by the mofo leg that was sticking out the top of a mangled filing cabinet. It appeared to have been there for quite some time, certainly long enough for a colocene of maggots to take up residence in the calf's skin, buzzing about how grateful they were, how wonderful life had become. the youthful arthropods were in full celebration, excitedly commemorating their sacred feast of meats, which precedes the phenomenal transformation wherein they blossom into shit-seeking houseflies. It was a sobering reminder that everything is a matter of perspective. All of them sounded drunk with happiness, fat with food and future, and disturbingly like Stevie Nicks. Blood spattered the office walls. One of those insidious, inspirational posters that said leadership was barely hanging onto its place on the wall. It had a bald eagle on it. Irksome. What the hell do bald eagles know about leadership? The excellence one had shattered on the ground. Flimsy poster, naked and exposed. It also had a bald eagle. I stepped on it, ripping the eagle's white head with my foot. It felt great. Some sort of tornado appeared to have ravaged the place. Rental agreements, keys, and packages littered the cramped office. "Find it, Dennis," I cawed. Dennis got to sniffing around, but I couldn't be sure he wasn't just looking for a rogue sausage. I poked my beak into the keyholes of the filing cabinet. They wouldn't open. The drawers of the desk were of particular interest to me. I pecked at the wooden fortresses, but couldn't persuade them to open sesame. By this point, Dennis was lying down with his paws over one of the packages. He got to work slapping it with his black toenails and tearing apart the cardboard with his teeth. I watched, impressed by his determination. Bright colors emerged from the brown box. Teals, pinks, chick yellow polka dots. Dennis had hit the mother lode. Artisanal chocolates and a package of elite handmade marshmallows. I hobbled over to him and immediately confiscated the chocolate, having seen how, after pillaging Hershey's bars, he could lacquer a living room. We shared the marshmallows and then got back to the hunt at hand. I hopped up the apartment building's stairs to the first floor. The corridor was right out of The Shining, dark but for the sliver of morning light that snuck in through a sad porthole. Various items lay strewn on the corridor's maroon carpet. A hairbrush, hair ties and pins, a bottle of Aquanet, an empty protein shake bottle. I had an idea. I sidled up to apartment 100 and wondered if it was possible. I snatched up one of the bobby pins and used my beak to straighten out the wire. Then I called Dennis to the door and hopped on his back, lining myself up with the lock. I inserted my pin into the lock and jostled, and jostled, and jostled. The jostling went on for quite some time until my beak was sore and Dennis kept sighing because he was bored shitless. I abandoned that idea, cursing MacGyver and his perfectly preened mullet. It had been a long shot, and even if I'd picked the lock, we still had the matter of the handle to deal with. The rest of the doors were all shut to us, save one. Apartment 107. 107 had a door, but it had gone several rounds with the machete that lay on its doormat. I approached with caution, Dennis plodding behind me. I could hear the mofo before I could see him. Bubbling gurgles echoed, bouncing off the once white walls of the apartment. I allowed tiny sparks of hope to rise inside me. Perhaps, just perhaps, we'd find one injured but not yet touched by sickness. The apartment was fancier than my home, with properly framed paintings that weren't just thrift store art like our kitchen masterpiece, Skeletor and Jesus Fly Fishing. Signs of a struggle announced themselves as upturned ottomans and pieces of porcelain on the floor. The musky smell of rotting algae filled the air. I found an aquarium filled with fish that had long since perished, floating like milk skin on a film of green. The gurgling persisted. Dennis got busy chewing a high heel with a red sole. Old habits die hard. I hadn't seen him this enthralled with a shoe since he was a puppy, so apparently not all footwear is created equal. I can't fault him. As Dennis has shown me, dogs eat shoes so their mofos don't leave the house. I left him happily squeaking leather on his canines and went to investigate the gurgling. The mofo was in a soaking tub, marinating in his own secretions. He was wrapped in rope that was knotted around both the curtain railing and the faucet. He wore a hairdryer and its cord as a necklace. Since his head was above the brown sludge, you could clearly see the burn on his face in the perfect outline of an iron. The red of it really set off the color of his eyes. There are bad days, and then there are days when you've been bitch-slapped with an iron. There was a pink letter opener sticking out of his neck, and a KitchenAid mixer bobbed in the water with him, still plugged into the wall socket. Perfumes and shampoo bottles and lotions lay all around the bathroom with their liquids now congealed on the floor, leading Detective ST to deduce that they'd been used as projectiles. When I put them together, the signs hinted at a potential domestic disagreement. Bloody prints, the dainty size of Big Jim's Tinder date's feet, led away from the bathroom and out the front door of the apartment. There had been a woman here, which meant... I summoned Dennis, excitedly insisting he join me in the excavation. After thoroughly ransacking the bathroom, I took my sleuthing skills to the bedroom, where clothes vomited from a dresser. Someone had been in a hurry to leave. I scoured the closet, disturbing dust clouds and pecking at mountains of clothes. No dice. Where did Tiffany S. used to leave hers? The kitchen smelled of rotting gases, of geriatric chicken eggs. But on the counter, next to a blood-slick hammer, a chair leg, and a spilled prescription of something called Clonopin, was a purse. I plunged my beak into the soft pink leather that was called Kate Spade and rifled through. A bottle of bear repellent, a wine opener, a ream of condoms, Alka-Seltzer, a mini bottle of Tabasco, a spring-assisted rainbow blade tactical hunting knife, and a sizable packet of Midol took up most of the space. Sign of a ladies' night out? I couldn't be sure. A note that had a list of names, like Downtown Emergency Services Center, Dr. Seuss Acupuncture and Herbs, Seattle Medical Center, CDC, and a list of corresponding phone numbers was crumpled at the bottom. Another note, this one in hurried handwriting, said, "Cash, canned food, flashlights, water. Find H, crossed out. Find Sarah. Find a way to Whidbey." Were the healthy mofos hiding out on Whidbey Island? Could it be? I swallowed my hope. In the side pocket of the pink bag called Kate Spade was what I was looking for. I chirped, opening the rectangular black case to find a compact mirror. Damn it! The expectant black bird peering back at me was not at all what I was looking for. I hopped up onto the perfume-stained couch, digging my beak into its crevices, a known treasure cache. Stuffed down the side of a cushion, a hidden velvet pouch had been sequestered, containing a packet of birth control pills, a receipt for Lovers, birthplace of Big Jim's blow-up dolls, and a bracelet, evidence of an affair. Dennis abandoned his shoe and disappeared into the closet. Moments later, he emerged with a look of jubilation, excited to show me what was dangling from his mouth. An Argyle sock. "No, Dennis, that's not what I asked for." His rudder of a tail swung left to right. Upon seeing my disapproval, he dropped the sock and retreated to the closet. I had decided we should leave apartment 107 when he reappeared. This time, he had an iPhone in his mouth. Open-beaked, I stared at the bloodhound I'd grossly underestimated his entire slobber-slimed life. Dennis returned to the high heel, flopping on the ground to resume masticating. "Good boy, Dennis! My dear Dennis had cracked the case!" I encouraged Dennis in shoe ecstasy, now having removed the heel and punctured through the scarlet sole, to say a small prayer as I pushed my beak on the power button. I held my breath. Dennis stopped chewing, staring at me with a giant saliva leash attached to the collapsed X-shoe. He emitted a thin whine. I hopped from side to side, waiting. "Come on." The phone's screen lit up, and in an instant, it was Christmas, July 4th, the Seahawks winning the Super Bowl, and a 7-Eleven-wide sale on Cheetos. I hopped up and down, unable to contain my glee. That cool electric beam was the same majestic luminance that came from the enchanted interior of a refrigerator, and Dennis and I stared, enjoying its instantly cloaking comfort, realizing how much we'd missed it, how long we'd been in the dark. I powered off the iPhone, and we got the hell out of that hideous apartment complex, making our way along Finney Avenue in search of the second part of my plan. There may or may not have been a very quick detour into a la mode pies, where Dennis snarfed down what looked to be an ancient cobbler. I helped myself to something that had once called itself a bourbon butterscotch pie, but only a little. I had to reel that shit in. Jesus, at this rate, if the predators didn't get us, the diabetes would. Still, a little sugar rush might not be the worst thing for what I was planning. I clutched the smartphone in my beak, feeling a growing sense of terror. The cell phone represented power, a lusted after treasure. All the sick mofos were wearing out their limbs and eyes, searching for its luminous glory. And in a world with no electricity, we had as long as the battery would last. We set down Finney Avenue back the way we came, under a bright overcast sky the color of silver silk. This time, I was the one who was hunting. On the road ahead, between the Ride the Ducks vehicle that lay on its side and a pile of empty beer crates, a willowy mofo wandered alone in front of us. He was naked as a mole rat, apart from the neon body paint splashed across his hairless torso that said "Live" in full color, and his unicorn hat. He staggered toward a corrugated metal sheet that had been torn from a storefront. He placed his twisted face up close to the metal and started to trace his eyes and head left and right, as if tracking something written in its grooves. On his back, the rainbow of paint spelled out, "Proceed with love and you will live forever." He was missing a butt cheek. We walked right past him. We knew he was lost in his sickness. I found my prey in the middle of the avenue, standing on letters where someone had poured out a message in gas and lit it on fire. "Turn it all off," the blackened message cried. She was staring at the sky, still and white as a birch. Her pants and vest were of shiny black leather, her hair a long silver rope. Tattoos spidered up her doughy arms, a naked pinup woman straddling a torpedo, a laughing skull wearing a beanie, a motorbike that was on fire. Art prophetically imitating life, seeing as how a Harley lay charred on the sidewalk nearby. She was corpulent, surprisingly intact, and with a wattle like Dennis's. She was absolutely perfect for my purposes. I croaked at Dennis, preparing him for what was to happen next. With his fur grasped in my feet, I could feel his stiffening reluctance to go near the biker mofo. But time had been brought back to our world in the form of a battery whose limited life drained away by the minute. We needed to act fast. We passed the biker mofo to give ourselves an advantage. I ruffled my feathers to calm my nerves, quietly telling myself that this was what I was good at. ST, A-plus honors student of luring, had become the teacher. Gingerly, I placed the cell phone onto Dennis's thick back. It was time. I used my beak to long press the power button, remembering Big Jim's delight the first time I'd gotten it right, the Cheeto reward, the cheddary flavor of success. "Good boy, shit turd." The phone lit up underneath me, an electric bright screen and an apple silhouette. I looked up. The biker mofo's neck snapped toward me, red eyes widening. A horrible, shrill whine streaked through the mid-morning silence. The unicorn mofo swiveled. Horn and penis swinging, he locked us in his sights. "Let's go!" I screeched at Dennis, driving my claws into his back. The mofos broke into a run. Dennis kicked into high gear, thundering across Finney Avenue. Ducking and clenching so hard my feet shook, I pressed against the wind that threatened to topple me from Dennis. A peek behind me revealed two mofos, necks craned forward, bouncing unblinking red eyes, their legs pounding the road at an unnatural speed. They were gaining on us. Dennis was fast, but he was no greyhound, and whatever the sickness was, it gave the mofos strength and speed they'd never had before. Another quick glance, the mofos had halved the distance between us. I could smell them, the hot scent of decay. I heard their tendons and bones creaking under the impact. They were galloping. "Faster, Dennis! Faster!" I told him with my feet and the panic seeping from my plumage. The biker let out a deafening shriek. The unicorn coughed back. They were gaining on us. We shot past more apartment buildings, the daycare center, and then I could see the Douglas fir pointing from the sky, and I said a small prayer that I made up on the spot as best as an agnostic crow can do. Then Dennis was hurling us up the stone steps of the teal and white house, and I jumped off his back using everything I had. I fluttered up to the window ledge, grasping its splintery wooden edge with my feet. I turned. The biker mofo was in the lead, silver rope swinging behind her, glistening leather and rolls of doughy white skin surging forth, pounding the stone steps, naked unicorn right on her heels. I had seconds to get it right. As her foot touched the welcome doormat, I whipped my head sideways, sending the iPhone airborne. Throwing myself from the ledge, I scattered out of the way. I heard the glass shattering before I had the chance to turn and witness the glory. The biker mofo burst through into the living room, rolling onto the ground and releasing the room's hot breath of fetid air. The unicorn scampered in after her. I fluttered back up the ledge to see both of them diving for the hardwood where the iPhone had settled. They huddled, necks craned unnaturally, worshipping the screen's bright glow. They extended their arthritic pointer fingers, tracing them listlessly against the iPhone's screen. Silence. It worried me. My eyes darted around the glass carpet, around the empty wrappers and dusty furniture. Where was Cinnamon? I bobbed my head in preparation. Then, in my best big gym, I said, "Shh! Come!" Several painful moments of stillness slogged by. Just decay and dog shit and broken mofos feeding their mysterious addiction. Had she run? Panicked and hurt herself? Had she curled up in a corner and... I couldn't bring myself to think of it. And then two tiny button eyes framed by a mane of flaming ginger appeared from under an armchair. "Shh! Come, quickly," I repeated. Cinnamon gave the mofos a skittish wide berth as she scuttled to the window. With one agile leap, she cleared the ledge and was met by Dennis, who had emerged from his hiding spot. He was especially goofy in his rapture, all dangling ears and flopping wattle and four left paws. He huffed in open-mouthed delight. The pair inspected one another's buttholes, upholding perhaps the very worst tradition from our old life, and Dennis offered the little redhead a play bow. Cinnamon didn't seem ready to play yet. She panted heavily, overexerted, high on freedom and fear. The whites of her eyes showed. I nipped that play shit in the bud, jumping on Dennis's back and rallying the troops forward. Cinnamon scurried to catch up, eager to escape the place she'd done hard time in. "You all right?" I asked her.
"Yes,"
came her response, as fragile as the first tinkling notes of a hummingbird hatchling. Perhaps it would take time for Cinnamon to be herself again. I would give her space to come around. Our little murder had grown, and the three of us had the rest of a purpose to carry out. We'd lost our bait to a biker and a unicorn, but I had another plan. And for the first time in an age, the clock was ticking.